Well, I'm honored to come back. I absolutely love the commitment of your church, number one, to community, but just to come together and wrestle with the big questions. And let's be honest, when it's all said and done, it's hard to think of a bigger question than the problem of evil, right? I mean, we're busy in life, we have deadlines, we have stresses, we're living our life from moment to moment, but if we ever just stop and think, one of the questions that seems to impress upon ourselves is, why does God allow evil and suffering in the world? In fact, what's interesting is I'm persuaded that this is at the root of why many people either leave their faith thing or they just don't consider becoming believers. The bottom line is we look at pain and suffering and we kind of think, if we were God, we could do a better job of alleviating the evil and pain and suffering we see in the world. Now, what's important is when we talk about the problem of evil, this is not calling into question the existence of God. What this is calling into question is the goodness of God. So I want to work through some material, begin to make sense of this. And then we're going to stop, and I made sure that we have time at the end for questions, for interaction, so I could do my best to help you make sense of this issue in your own life. But let me just tell you something. If you come here tonight and you think that in an hour you're going to walk away and have it figured out why God allows evil, you're going to walk away disappointed. You're going to walk away disappointed. If you think I can stand here and go, here's exactly why God allowed this to happen in your life, here's exactly why God allowed this historical event to happen, you're going to walk away disappointed. So when we approach this question of the problem of evil, the question is not, can we answer every question that arises, wrap it up like a present and put a bow on it? The bigger question is, which worldview, which belief system makes the best sense intellectually and existentially when we look at the world? So if Christianity, if I can't stand up here and answer every question that you have, the question is, does atheism answer it better? Does Buddhism answer it better? And to me, I'm a Christian because when all things are considered, I think it's the Christian worldview and the person of Jesus in particular that makes the best sense of why there's evil and has the best solution or response to the evil that we see and the evil that we experience. But amazingly, when you look at some of the great thinkers throughout the history of the world, really their problem was evil. So even Einstein famously said, God does not play dice with the universe. But he couldn't reconcile evil and suffering in the world with a God who actually cared. A lot of people don't know that this is true for Charles Darwin. Many people think it was his science that drove him away from God. But if you read The Origin of Species, it's really kind of science disguised in a sense of the suffering and pain he sees in the world that doesn't feel like there can be a good, caring designer. He was profoundly affected by the early death of his daughter. Even Bart Ehrman, who in my perspective, if you haven't heard of Bart Ehrman, somebody asked me recently and said, which living person on the planet do you think has raised the biggest challenge for Christians? I would say Bart Ehrman. He went to Moody College, he went to Wheaton, and is a leading textual critic on the Bible. Brilliant scholar. But what's interesting is he wrote this. He left his faith and is now kind of an agnostic slash atheist. He said, I left the faith for what I took to be and still take to be an unrelated reason. The problem of suffering in the world. But you know what? This isn't just a question that non-believers ask. It's not like there's just atheists and skeptics from the outside looking in at Christianity and saying, before I believe, I want you to make sense of why there's evil. It's a question you and I have asked, right? All of us at some point have experienced evil. We've seen evil. We've been up at night just looking and going, man, God, why does this happen? In fact, I find myself more and more saying, you know, God, just come and return, please, because the evil is so great. You look at things like ISIS in the world and what happened to these Christians. We're not honest with ourselves if we don't look at that and beat our chest and say, God, why? God, come. Please come and stop this. In fact, the prophet Habakkuk in the Old Testament, the book of Habakkuk, he's really wrestling with evil and suffering. He says, how long, O Lord, must I call for help and you do not listen? Or cry out to you violence, but you do not save? You know, I think this issue is so difficult because it's not just an intellectual issue. This is not an issue like examining the textual transmission of the New Testament. This is not like solving a geometrical problem. This is an issue we felt, we've experienced, and we've seen. So it's probably impossible for any of us just to say, okay, let's intellectually try to answer the problem of evil when we've experienced it in our life and we've suffered. In fact, all of us in greater and lesser degrees have made choices that have caused other people to suffer. And we feel this issue. And I'll never forget, I've been married to my high school sweetheart for 15 years next month. 15 years. We grew up, thank you, one person appreciates that. I'm kidding. We grew up, I think I mentioned this last time, we grew up in Julian. You guys been to Julian for the apple pie and my best friend's mom started Mom's Apple Pie when I was in like third grade. So I was sitting in the back peeling apples. That's where I grew up. And I married my high school sweetheart I knew since third grade. In fact, my first memory of my wife, in third grade, I was riding on the bus. And my friend Jesse, whose mom started Mom's Pie Shop, had a crush on this girl named Stephanie. And I went over and I sat by her because Jesse asked me to ask if this girl Stephanie liked him. So I went on the bus and I asked to sit next to Stephanie. I said, hey, Jesse, thinks you're cute. What do you think about Jesse? I don't remember what she said. But the bottom line is I married her and he didn't. In fact, it might explain why my favorite song is the 80s song, Jesse's Girl, Yes! Students look at me like, what is Jesse's Girl? But you guys can appreciate this. Well, we've been married 15 years. We have three kids that we just love. About 3 years ago, I'll never forget, our first two kids were just easy. It was smooth. My wife was pregnant with our third, and we went to the doctor's office. I think, I don't know, somewhere between 8 and 12 weeks to do the first ultrasound. And we're sitting in the office, and I remember it's just taking the nurse a little while longer to find the heartbeat. And it pauses for a while, and she turns to us. She didn't have very good bedside manner, so to speak. She turns to them and goes, hey, I can't find the heartbeat. Maybe we should go to another room and check where there's less light. I mean, that was like a ton of bricks. She said it flipping like, hey, do you want cheese on your burger? I mean, it was seriously. And I remember thinking, holy cow. And it ended up my wife had a miscarriage. And I have a friend who had 5 miscarriages and a friend who had 8. So my pain, I know some of you have been through much more pain than that, but I distinctly remember at that point going, man, God, you could have stopped this. But why did this happen? And just feeling the pain and the hurt of this fallen world. Now, my wife is pretty upbeat, but I remember she turned to me and she literally said, I've never heard her say this. She goes, I'm feeling depressed. And it was just this season where we started to ask this question more poignantly and personally than ever before. So as we talk about if there's God, why is there evil? All of us have experienced suffering and pain in our life. So we can't just separate that from trying to solve why God allows this. In fact, as we make sense of this issue, it might be helpful if I break it down like this. Into 2 ways we can break up the problem of evil, so to speak. And the first one is what we'll call the emotional problem of evil. And that's just when somebody suffers. That's when somebody's hurting and they need a pastoral, loving response. When I graduated from Biola University, I spent a year traveling with my dad, just being his assistant around the world, around the country. And we were in Breckenridge, Colorado, this beautiful ski town. It's probably 9,000 feet up. I think maybe 21, 22 years old. I had just taken an apologetics class with J.P. Moreland, the great J.P. Moreland, graduated from Biola, and I was just armed with this apologetics ammo to answer anybody who's going to try to challenge my faith. Well, I go in to get a haircut, and there's probably a lady between 25 and 30 years old. And I sit down, and I had this book that I set on the counter, a Christian book I was reading, and she goes, oh, is that a Christian book? I said, yeah. She kind of perked up with interest. She said, do you mind if I ask you a question? I said, no, go ahead. She said, I've always wondered why, if God is so good and powerful, why is there so much evil and suffering in the world? And to my eternal shame, my first thought was, that's all you got? Like that inside, I'm thinking, that's why you're not a believer in God? How hard is it? So I jumped in. I said, well, I mean, think about it. Look, God has to give us free will. He doesn't want us to be robots. I mean, you can't have evil without good. You can't have good without God. So actually, your question presumes there's a God. She asked a question. Bam, I was ready with an answer. Inside, I'm thinking, this is awesome. She's asking questions. I'm just knocking down these barriers so she can get close to Jesus. Well, like a typical male, I was essentially clueless to the emotions of the female in front of me. Can I get an amen from the women who know what I'm talking about? Okay, good. There are some Baptists here. All of a sudden, in the middle of this, she just stops and she starts to cry. And looking in the mirror, I remember catching her eyes, and she says, this is a bunch of expletive, you can fill in the blank. She says, you've got an answer for everything. It can't be that easy. And I remember sitting there actually being really nervous because she was holding scissors to my head. I'm seriously like, she could just stab me and like, you know, arrogant preacher boy killed for showing no compassion, right? That would make the front of the news. So I gave her a big tip because I felt bad. We're walking out and I said to my friend Jason was there, I was like, man, what's up with her? We're having a great conversation. I'm trying to make sense of this. And he stopped and he goes, McDowell, do you have any sense of how arrogant you were to her? And those words hit me like a ton of bricks. He said, you know, you showed no compassion. You had simple answers. And didn't try to actually help her with the real question she was asking. And it hit me. When she said, why does God allow evil and suffering? What do you think she was really asking? Was she asking for me to provide an intellectual response and to make sense of God and evil and other worldviews and truth? No. My guess is she was asking about some pain or hurt she'd experienced in her life. And if God's real and caring, why doesn't he show the compassion the Bible says God shows at times? So I've learned something the hard way, that when somebody asks me, in particular a young person, about the problem of evil, unless I'm on the radio or the format, I almost always ask a question back. And my question is, if someone says to me, hey, Sean, why does God allow evil? I'll say something like, gosh, that's a really important and thoughtful question. Of all the questions you can ask about God, why that one? Because you know why? I want to know what's behind the question. And if somebody says, because you know what? I was grown up and my parents divorced when I was 3. I was abused. I got bullied at school. My friend in elementary school got cancer. Then what do you know? They're not asking for an intellectual response to it. They want comfort. They need a pastoral, loving, caring response. So especially on this issue, when we talk about evil and pain and suffering, we have to err on the side of showing grace, err on the side of showing compassion, and trying to understand what question is being asked. Now, what I have found is when people can intellectually make sense of who God is and his character and what evil is and where it came from, those truths can help through the process of suffering. But sometimes the worst thing we can do as Christians is someone's suffering, and what do? We give them a Bible verse. Well, Romans says all things work together for the good. Turn that frown upside down. And what do? We end up causing more hurt than we do good. So I think sometimes, myself included, we just feel awkward when people are suffering. We don't know what to do. And maybe some of that is being human. Maybe some of that is, as Americans in Western culture, we feel like we have to have a solution for everything, right? Every problem on TV, they solve it within 30 minutes and they move on. It's like we're not comfortable with there being pain and hurt. I'll never forget, some of our friends, and some of you probably would know this family, their son died at 15 years old of cancer. so about 3 or 4 years ago, so painful. I'll never forget something he said. He said, sometimes the greatest present you can give somebody is your presence. And he's right. So I'm not a trained counselor. I'm not going to pretend to be a trained counselor. But as we talk about this issue, it's so important that we frame it this way and make sure we have compassion and care. And that's why one of my favorite passages in the Bible I found helpful is in Romans 12:15. It says, rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. My son comes in yesterday with his homework. He got really good grades and he throws it on my desk. He was happy if I said, son, I don't have time. Come back later. What have I done? He's happy. He wants me to be happy with him. Son, that's awesome. I'm proud of you. Way to go. On the other hand, if somebody's hurting, what do? The human, loving Christian response is to just hurt with them. You know what's interesting? We see this in the life of Job. So you've all read the story of Job. Job lost his family. He lost his health. He lost his home. He lost his reputation. He physically has boils all over his body. He's sitting in the ashes, hardly recognizable. And his friends come to see him. And they did everything right. A lot of people miss this. Job's friends did everything right until they opened up their mouths. And they ruined it. Do you know if you read the story what they did? For the first entire week, they just sat there mourning with Job. And then their words screwed it up. So we're going to move on because I'm a professor and I want us to help make sense of this. But it's important that when we're talking with people, we try to understand what question are they really asking and deal with the question they're really asking. I've just spent too much time in my life answering a question that nobody's actually really answering. So let's move on and let's talk about what we're going to call the philosophical problem of evil. The philosophical problem of evil. So this is really a sense of why would a good, loving God allow there to be evil? Now we're jumping into philosophy class. We're jumping into apologetics, trying to make sense of why God allows there to be evil. And again, why is this important? There's a radio talk show host I enjoy listening to by the name of Dennis Prager. He's Jewish. Brilliant and insightful. How many of you listen to Dennis Prager? Okay, good. Dennis Prager has a book, and the title is Happiness is a Serious Problem. It's a great book. And he says in there, he says that couples who experience the sudden loss of a child, according to his research, he said a majority of them would get divorced or separated because of the tragedy and pain of it. This 15-year-old who died that I mentioned, his parents ended up getting divorced. He wanted to know why some couples could withstand the pain and some couples couldn't. You know what he writes in that book? He said it was couples who had a biblical or a philosophical sense of why God allows evil, that even though it was incredibly painful, they could make sense of it and weather the storm. So understanding why, even though I'm not going to wrap a present and put a bow on it, getting a sense of what evil is, where it comes from, how Christianity makes sense of it, I believe really can help us to a degree in our lives when we're confronted with suffering and evil. So the time to learn that is before, right? Not afterwards. It helps us cope with that. Well, the place to start with is one thing my dad taught me is he always would tell me, he'd say, son, define your words. It's amazing how many people talk about love and I'll say, can you give me a definition of love? And the guy goes, I don't know what love is. How many people could really define love? I had a guy recently say you're homophobic. And I said, okay, that's a serious charge. Can you define what homophobia is? He looks at me and goes, no. I said, then how can you call me that if you can't define it? Well, if we're talking about why God allows evil, it seems important to take a step back and ask, what is evil? What does it actually mean? Well, I was, again, getting my hair cut, and there's no rhyme and reason why all these things happen when I'm getting my hair cut. But planes and haircuts seem to spur on philosophical thoughts, don't they? People just talk for some reason. Well, I was getting my hair cut here in San Juan Capistrano, and the guy who's cutting my hair and some lady sitting on the other side started having this discussion about evil. And the lady says, I think evil is like two equal and opposite forces. That there's good and they're evil and they're pairing against each other. And I jumped in, I said, I don't think that's an accurate view of evil. And I think if you reflect upon it more, you realize that that doesn't describe what evil is. So C.S. Lewis, who's one of the most influential apologists, and not even apologists, one of the most influential writers of literature in the 20th century, used to be an atheist. I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but he was an atheist for a long period of time. And in his book, Mere Christianity, he wrote something that's very interesting. He said, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I gotten this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Now, do you see the brilliant insight that Lewis is making? He's saying, as an atheist, he looked in at the Christian worldview and he said, wait a minute, if there's this loving God and there's all this injustice, then this loving God can't exist. But then he said, wait a minute. If I'm calling the world unjust, that means there must actually be some objective standard of justice. And if there's an objective standard of justice, then there must be some source outside of the physical world to ground this standard of justice. So the point is this. You can have good without evil, but you can't have evil without good. You can have good without evil, but you can't have evil without good. So it's not like the Tao symbol that I was mentioning in yin yang, how there's good and there's evil and there's these equal and opposite forces. I think if we reflect upon it, we all know that this really isn't what evil is. Rather, evil is parasitic upon good. What I mean by that is you can't have evil unless you have something first that is good to be twisted. So evil is really good twisted. Now, good is its own standard, but evil is good twisted. So you can have good that's never twisted, but you can't have good twisted, which is evil, unless you first have good. So are you with me? Okay, good. I'll use multiple illustrations to break this down. Maybe some of you already get this, but when I first thought about this, the lights went on. It helped me frame this whole conversation. Okay, so a parasite can only exist if there's a host. The host doesn't need the parasite needs the host. Evil is parasitic upon good. So what Lewis said in his quote is he talked about not calling something crooked unless you first have a standard of what? Straight. By definition, we can look at what straight is. It's a defining by itself. But when you call something crooked or bent, that depends upon there first being a standard of straight. So bentness is like evil, twisting the standard of straight, which we would call good. So here's another way to maybe think about it. What's more basic, truth or a lie? This is the participatory part of the program. What's more basic, truth or a lie? Truth. Can you have truth without there being a lie? Sure. Can you have a lie without there being truth? No. Truth by definition, a lie by definition is when you don't tell the truth. So a lie makes no sense unless there's a standard of truth. Like on a test, right? You can have all correct answers, but you can only get a wrong answer if there's first what? A standard of right. So evil is parasitic upon good. Now, one or two other ways. Think about it this way. Take a wrench, right? You have an original design for a wrench. Well, what happens when a wrench, say, corrodes? What does it start to get? It starts to get rusty, right? Now, can you have rust without first having metal? No. Rust, by definition, is metal that's been corroded. So you have the original design, which is the metal and the wrench. And then when it goes rusty, that's when that design gets corroded. So the rust is like evil. It depends upon their first being good. I'll give you one more example, even though I think this is sinking in. Take healthy teeth. Now, some of you know where this is going, don't you? Let me just spare you the pain, speaking of pain and suffering. Don't Google tooth decay. I Googled it, like, I just need a moderate picture to make the point. I Googled it and was like, oh, man, what am I thinking? Right? You'd think I would have learned my lesson by now. Embedded into my mind. Don't worry, this is going to be mild at the kind of pictures. Now, you know about what I'm going to show. You have healthy teeth. What happens when teeth are no longer healthy and kids eat too many Starbursts? What happens? You get tooth decay, right? When teeth go bad, you get decay. And trust me, that's mild. But can you have decay without there first being such a thing as healthy teeth? No. Decay is parasitic, and it's when good teeth go bad. Friends, that's what evil is in the world. It's when things are not the way they're supposed to be, or they are the way they're not supposed to be. Both of those imply that there's a design and a purpose in the world for how the world is supposed to be. Well, if there's a God, then it makes sense that there would be a way the world is supposed to be. But if there is no God, is there even a way the world is supposed to be? No. So atheists can complain or raise the problem of evil. Of course they can. It's a legitimate question. But they can only raise the problem of evil and call the world evil if they borrow from the Judeo-Christian worldview, which gives us the idea of evil, to turn around and critique the Christian worldview. Do you see the irony of this? I have a friend named Frank Turek. He's an author, and he's written a lot of great books. And his whole point is, and I'll put it up here, that evil is a corruption of what is good. Evil is a corruption of what is good. So to have evil, you must have good. But if there's good, there must be a God. So he was in a public debate with the late atheist Christopher Hitchens. Now, Christopher Hitchens was just brilliant. He was one of the most influential atheists, probably the past half century. He had a British accent and long hair, which I don't have either of those, which gave him kind of a cool factor, right? You have a British... Well, he's got a British accent, and he wrote a book, very influential, which the title was God is Not Great. The subtitle, How Religion Poisons Everything. And he was debating my friend Frank. And the whole premise of Christopher was, he's saying religion has done nothing but cause evil and bad and suffering in the world. And Frank, he said, wait a minute. If you're condemning religion as being evil, then there must first be a standard of good. But you can't even get a standard of good unless there's first a God. He said, Christopher, your whole argument is that the world is evil, which assumes there's good. And if there's good, there must be God. Your whole argument assumes that God exists. And at the end of his debate, he said, Christopher, you sit on God's lap to slap him in the face. Now, that's a pretty good line. I had a debate about 4 or 5 years ago with this high school teacher at Capo. I won't mention his name. You could Google it online and find it, an outspoken kind of skeptic who's a teacher there. And I really wanted to use that line because we were debating God and morality. My wife was like, no, you can't. I said, why not? She said, Frank is from Jersey. He can get away with it. You're from Southern California. You'll sound like a punk surfer kid. So I couldn't drop the line in the debate, but it's sticky, doesn't it? Like, you remember that and it makes sense. Now, this doesn't tell us why God allows evil. It doesn't answer it. But what I'm trying to do is frame the question and say that even within us, when we cry out for justice, when we cry out and call things evil, when we cry out and call things good, we call things not good, that's because deep inside we're made in the image of God. And we know there's purpose. We know there's goodness. We know there's beauty. And we know the world is not the way it's supposed to be. And if it's not the way it's supposed to be, then we know there is a plan and there is a design for how, in fact, the world is supposed to be. So the cry about evil shows us that deep within, we really know there's such a thing as good. Now, let's try to make sense of the problem of evil itself. Sam Harris is a well-known atheist, and I think he states it about as clearly as anybody I've heard. He says this. He said, if God exists, either he can do nothing to stop the most egregious calamities, or he does not care to. God, therefore, is either impotent, lacks the power, or evil. There is another possibility, of course, and it is both the most reasonable and least odious. The biblical God, is a fiction like Zeus and the thousands of other dead gods whom most sane beings now ignore. So if we put this in syllogism form, here's essentially what the problem of evil is. If God is all-powerful, he can stop evil. Now I'm curious, how many of you believe God is all-powerful? Let me see your hands. Okay. So we believe God can stop evil. Second, if God is all-good, he would want to stop evil. How many of you believe God is all-good? Okay. Third, evil exists. Therefore, an all-powerful, all-good God does not exist. This is the argument, at least one version of the argument. There's many different problems of evil. This is the most common one put into different premises with a conclusion. Now, if we believe that God exists and he's good and all powerful, what do we have to do to avoid that conclusion? Someone tell me, what do we have to do so that conclusion doesn't follow? Yeah, we have to show that at least one of these premises is false. Well, the Buddhist or Eastern religion view is to deny premise number three. It's true. There really are no distinctions between me and you. No distinctions between religions. There's no distinction between good and evil. All is one. So evil is essentially an illusion. Now, let me ask you a question. Does that ring true to you? I don't know anybody who saw that man in Jordan, that pilot, who was burned alive and thought, whew, I'm glad that didn't happen and it's just an illusion. I mean, everybody, unless you were an extremist with ISIS, was just pained by that. I remember hurting, going, oh my goodness, this is terrible. Can we really look at something like that? These people that are beheaded and just say, well, it's an illusion. So that's one move that the whole Eastern religion makes. But for me, I don't find that intellectually or existentially matching up with the world as we really know it to be. You and I know that there's such a thing as evil. We know it. So the question is, are premises one and premises two also true? Well, let's take a look at the first premise. If God is all powerful, he can stop evil. Now, you raise your hand and said you believe God is all-powerful. Here's my question. How many believe God can do anything? Let me see your hands. God can do anything. Okay, looks like most of you. All right. What's your name, buddy?
Andrew.
Andrew? How old are you? 18 years old. Are you high school senior or college freshman? High school senior. Good for you, buddy. Are you ready? Because I have something for you. And if you, I've got a paperclip. And I'm wondering if you can bend this into a square circle for me. Come on up. Andrew, you said? You know what your name means, by the way? You don't know what Andrew means? You should know this. It means manly and brave. It does. That means God has his hand on you. You're going to be a brave soldier for him, like Andrew, the brother of Peter, who was the first missionary, by the way. Anyways, if you can take this paperclip and bend it into a square circle, I will personally give you a full scholarship to Biola University. A square circle. He's actually trying it.
Yeah, I don't think that exists.
That doesn't exist? Okay, what if we had our former governor in the house? Could Arnold Schwarzenegger turn this into a square circle? No. Here's the question. Does it matter how much power we add? Can any amount of power make it possible for this to be a square circle? No. So somebody could be all powerful and yet not able to turn this into a square circle. That's not a limitation on power. That's a realization that such a thing called a square circle cannot exist regardless of how much power somebody has, right? So this is kind of the famous conundrum and discussion people have in theology class. Could God make a rock so big that he can't move it? Or as Bart Simpson would say, could God make a burrito so big that he can't eat it? What's the point? The point is, when you say, can God make a rock so big he can't move it? If you say yes, he can do it, he's limited because he can't do it. If you say no, God can't do it, then God is limited because here's something he can't do. And the skeptic says, ha, either way you answer, God is not all powerful. And the answer is, we have to properly understand what we mean when we say that God is all powerful. When we say God is all powerful, did this die on me? What is going on? My disc is full. This is not a sales pitch for Disneyland. When we say God is all powerful, we don't mean God can do anything, period. We mean God can do anything that power can do, right? But then there's something else God can't do. You guys raise your hand and said God can do anything. Can God lie? Who thinks God can lie? Now, on some Muslim theology, God can lie. But in Christian theology, God is truth in his very character. The Bible says that God can't be tempted. You say, I can lie, I can be tempted. God can't lie, God can't be tempted. I have more power than God. No, you're seeing it backwards. To lie is not a strength, it's a weakness. To be tempted is not a power, it's a lack of perfection, it's an imperfection. Because God is so holy, he will necessarily do what is right. He will necessarily do what is good. That's why a couple passages in particular, it says in Hebrews 6:18, God can't lie. He can't lie. It says in James 1:13, God cannot be tempted by evil. So what's my point? Can God create a world without evil? Can God create a world without evil? Let me see your hands. Who says yes? Sure he can. Can God stop evil? Yes. Someday he's going to. Someday, for reasons we don't know, God is going to stop evil. Could be 5 minutes, could be 5 decades, could be 5,000 years. We don't know. But can God create a world with beings who are genuinely free and then force that those beings necessarily choose what is good? If God forces us to do that which is good, then we're not free. If God gives us genuine free will, then he can't force us to do good. So yes, God can create a world without evil, but even God can't create a world with genuine free will and then determine that we must choose good. Alvin Plantinga, arguably the greatest living philosopher, he said this. He said, a world containing creatures who are significantly free is more valuable, all else being equal, than a world containing no free creatures at all. Now, God can create free creatures, but he can't cause or determine them to only do what is right. For if he does so, then they aren't significantly free after all. To create creatures capable of moral good, therefore, he must create creatures capable of moral evil. And he can't give these creatures the freedom to perform evil and at the same time prevent them from doing so. I think that's right. Now, this raises a whole host of other questions. I realize that. But logically speaking, we realize that the first premise of our solution here is not necessarily true in terms of counting against God being all powerful. What about the second premise? If God is all good, he would want to stop evil. Now again, how many of you believe God is all good? Let me see your hands. Looks like most, if not all of you, believe God is all good. Well, we look out and we see people suffering, and whenever we can, we stop it. We're not as good as God, so why doesn't God reach in and stop the suffering and the evil? Well, I had a friend who I've talked to for over a decade about God. And this friend of mine is brilliant. Really, really, really smart. And For years, I'd talk about intelligent design, historical Jesus, when it was appropriate, never force it on, just having conversations. And he liked intellectual discussion, but was never interested. And then at one point, he called me out of the blue and said, "Hey, Sean, you teach your students how to defend Christianity, right?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Where do you start? How do you know God is real?" I about fell over when I was standing on the phone. And of course, my first question, my response was, "Man, I'm happy to help you, but why are you calling me?" He said, "Well, my brother at this stage was a teenager and he had cancer." And a direct quote said, "It's shaken me up to realize my own mortality." Isn't it interesting that we tend to go through life concerned with the tasks in front of us? But sometimes when they're suffering, sometimes when they're pain, it makes us stop and cry out for justice and reflect upon the big questions that when it's all said and done, really matter. C.S. Lewis said, "God whispers in our pleasure, but he shouts in our pain." And I think he's right. Some of you might recognize the name Francis Collins. He was the director of the National Institute of Health. In fact, I think he may still be under Obama. He's an evangelical Christian, and for years he was an atheist. And his story was, when he was going through medical school, he was assigned to work in hospice. And that's what they call it where people are preparing to die, right? I got my term right, correct, medical people? Okay, good, thank you. He was assigned to work in hospice. And he didn't believe in God at all. And he said something that kind of got his attention was seeing these people die. They responded to death all very differently. But there was a peace. There was a confidence. There was a calmness about the Christians who died. And something in his heart and soul wanted to know what gave them that strength. And so we started to probe him. And one girl, lady who was dying, she said, "Well, you ought to read C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity." And that's the end of the story. He reads it and becomes compelled that there must be a God. So I'm not going to pretend to know why God allows every instance of evil. We don't know unless God tells us. But isn't it interesting that the suffering and the evil in the world gets our attention, gets us to reflect on eternal things? And I think this is particularly hard for us in America because we think if we're blessed by God, then what happens? I'm blessed. I got a big paycheck, got a great vacation, nice home, and a nice car. We associate blessing with material things. Which woman was blessed above all in the Bible? It was Mary. Do you know she had to watch the brutal execution of her son? When you're a parent and you think about that being a blessing, that puts a very different spin on what blessing is. See, we've been told in American Christianity as a whole is that if you just come to church, God will fix your marriage, fix your self-image. God will make your life better. I just finished spending between 2 and 3 years studying the fate of the apostles. What really happened to Peter? What really happened to John, to Thomas, to Andrew, who was one of the most fascinating? And you know what? From the beginning of Acts, you read the first few chapters, they're threatened, they're thrown in prison, they're beaten. And then we see Stephen, and we see James killed, and Peter's life threatened. I read the whole New Testament and underlined in my digital Bible every reference that was made to suffering and persecution. You know what surprised me? Is every book in the Bible, except I think maybe 3 John, every New Testament book was either a minor or a major theme that Christians should expect suffering. Why? Something about our souls, right? None of us want suffering, but we know when we look at our life that sometimes it's the pain that purges our souls and makes us grow as people and gives us an appreciation and a value for life we simply wouldn't have without that kind of suffering. We don't want it, we resist it. but somehow it makes us more like Christ. So maybe, just maybe, maybe because God is good, he doesn't cause, but he allows some suffering. Because God is more concerned with your soul and your eternal destiny than your present comfort. If you don't take it from me, some of you will recognize this baseball player. I'm going to play a short clip because I think his story is quite powerful. Dave Dravecki.
I had the wonderful experience of seeing a boyhood dream become a reality. I wanted to be a major league pitcher, and I found myself pitching for the San Diego Padres. I'll never forget June 8th of 1982 when I got called up from the minor leagues, and I was now in the big leagues and living this dream. For the next 5 years, I was in the San Diego Padres organization and then got traded over to San Francisco and in many respects, a new lease on life with the Giants. And I'll never forget opening day 1988, pitching against the Dodgers. We win 5-1, and I'm on my way to what I thought was going to be a 20-win season. Now, all of a sudden, a small lump develops in my left arm, being a left-handed pitcher, not a good thing. And by September of that year, the doctors were telling me that that lump was cancer. And so my world came crumbling down. And the doctors looked at me and said, outside of a miracle, you'll never pitch again. Well, for the next 10 months, I went through rehab, and I had to try because I didn't want to live with that question looming over my head. If I never tried, then could I have come back to play again? So off I embarked on this journey to come back. And August 10th, 1989, I'm standing on the mound again in Candlestick Park for the San Francisco Giants, getting ready to pitch against the Cincinnati Reds. And it's the miracle of the comeback. We win that game 4-3. I'm back in the saddle. Everything's going great. 5 days later, we're in Montreal pitching against the Expos. It's the sixth inning. I rear back and I throw a fastball to Tim Raines. My left arm snaps in half. From there, obviously, the cancer reoccurs. I retire from baseball and I go through the next battle in this journey through pain and suffering. And the cancer, along with radiation treatments, a staph infection, all of that culminating with June 18th, 1991, having the left arm and shoulder amputated to save my life. And in the midst of that, there were a number of questions that were looming around this issue of pain and suffering. And I'll never forget going on Barbara Walters and on 2020, and she had actually point blank asked me, why did God make you suffer? That's an amazing question. Amazing question. And to be honest with you, I didn't know how to answer it at the time. Why did God make me suffer? Did God make me suffer? But in the end, this whole idea of suffering is so much bigger than what I think we can discover here on this earth. So much bigger. And we really can't see everything that God's doing, but I do know one thing, I can trust God in the midst of it. And the bottom line is that through this journey, there was always hope because of what Christ did for me on the cross. There was always hope. Now, in the midst of the pain and the suffering, there were days that were so hard. I experienced clinical depression. I had fear, I had doubt, I had worry. And at the end of all of that, there were choices that I had to make. And there were two choices in particular. I could either look at this experience and walk away from God, or I could move directly towards the heart of God and trusting Him to provide the strength I would need to get to the other side of this. And that's what I chose. I chose the path of hope. I chose the path of encouragement and comfort and strength that comes through knowing God through His Son, Jesus Christ. And with that hope, I'm here today, and I can say that cancer's been a blessing in my life.
Those are pretty strong words you don't hear. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say, cancer's been a blessing in my life. I haven't had to deal with cancer personally, my guess is many of you here, and the first word that comes to our mind is not blessing. But from someone who's been through it, that's a pretty powerful, powerful perspective. And I think ultimately, a God kind of oriented way to think about it. Well, so far what we've done is we've said, here's the problem of evil, how it's posed against Christianity. Here's what evil is. And in a sense, when we define evil, we realize it actually points towards the existence of God. We've shown that, yes, God is all powerful, but even God can't make free beings who necessarily choose good. We've seen that maybe because God is good, He allows some evil and suffering for a period of time. But the question, and in some ways the most important question, is what does Christianity uniquely say about the problem of evil? So far, different religions could claim some of the truths that we've pointed out, but what does Christianity uniquely contribute? And to me, there's one main thing that separates Christianity apart. And it reminds me of a story. In 1873, there was a priest by the name of Father Damien. And Father Damien was so moved by the idea that some of these lepers on Molokai, this island at the time on the back small island of Hawaii, this colony of lepers were dying without anybody to care for them. They were like banished to be alone and just slowly waste away. So before a lot of modern medicine, we knew why it was spread, how people got it. Father Damien felt compelled to go be a priest for these people. So he moved to Molokai. He prayed for these people. He preached to them. He prepared them food. He counseled them. He buried them. He built caskets for them. He loved these people for years. But then one day he stood up and he gave a message. And this message, he did something that changed everything. Father Damien stood before the colony of lepers. And he opened up his coat. And he said, "We lepers." And he showed on his body the first signs of leprosy. Now let me ask you something. Before he got leprosy, do you think they appreciated and loved Father Damien? Absolutely. Do you think after he got leprosy, the depth of their love for him increased? Absolutely, because they realize what it cost them. Here's the question. Is Jesus' response to suffering and evil more like Father Damien before he got leprosy or Father Damien after he got leprosy? And I think you see where I'm going with this. It's only in Christianity that says God got his hands, so to speak, dirty. God did not just send a prophet. God did not just send an angel or a book or solve the problem of evil from a distance. The second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ, took on human flesh, entered into our world, and experienced the weight of suffering and pain that we experienced. This is a God who actually understands and empathizes with us when we suffer. So you look at the different symbols of the world, religious symbols. You've got the crescent and the star for Islam. On the right corner, you've got the Star of David. You've got the Shinto kind of gates to this other realm. And then in the bottom, of course, you've got the chubby Buddha. Well, what's the unique Christian symbol? What is it? It's the cross. Have you ever really thought about the fact that the defining symbol of our religion is a torture instrument? We wear it as earrings, we wear it on rings, we wear it as jewelry, we put it on our walls. It's this wonderful symbol, and I'm not necessarily opposed to that. But I think we kind of lose that, you know what, out of the cross was actually a term for excruciating. In Latin, it means out of the cross because it was a scientifically devised torture mechanism to humiliate and cause the most pain imaginable publicly so people wouldn't stand against the Roman Empire or early against the Persian Empire. It's a torture machine. And yet that's the defining symbol of our religion. What does this tell us? It tells us that we follow and worship a God who has been there. Some people say, where is God when I'm suffering? Part of the response is God is right there, suffering with you. He actually understands in a way that no other God can claim to understand. And we see this laid out in the scriptures. For example, Isaiah the prophet in Isaiah chapter 53 said the coming Messiah would be a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering. Hebrews 4:15 says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tested in every way as we are, yet without sin." We follow a God who hurts with us. Now, again, that raises other questions. I realize that. But that's powerful. That's a powerful way to make sense and to help grieving what God's response is. That God is not distant. Ultimately, I'll be honest with you. If you come up to me afterwards and say, "Why was my cousin die of cancer? Why did God allow the man in Jordan to be burned?" If you want me to give you an answer for that, I don't know. I don't know. Unless God actually reveals that to us. But here's what I do know. I know the darkest period in the life of Jesus was when he was on the cross. His closest followers thought that this man they were following, they were going to reign in this world and the world to come with him. He's going to be the one who's going to destroy the Romans. When he's arrested and killed, their dreams were shattered. From their perspective, everything was lost. Do you know what the irony is? At what seemed to be the darkest moment, God was the most in control. And God was taking what was evil and seemed to have no purpose and using it for his ultimate good. That's why Joseph, to his brothers who certainly did evil to him, when they're crying out for Joseph's grace, he says, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." I don't think we can make sense of evil and suffering without the cross and then ultimately without the resurrection. Because the resurrection tells us that death is not the end. The enemy has been defeated. Death does not have the last word. It doesn't. That's why throughout history, Christians could die and be martyred. Why? Because they believe you can kill my body, but you can't kill my soul. I worship a God who has risen the dead and risen himself. That's why I love when Pilate turns to Jesus and says, "You know, I have power over you." And Jesus is just laughing, saying, "You have power over me? Yeah, I'm going to die, but I'm the one who gives you breath. I'm the one who allows your heart to beat. I have not abandoned this world. And God is going to move it for good." That's why in 1 Corinthians 15, after we get the great resurrection passage, Paul says, "O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting?" Amen? Now, I think much more could be said about this. And in some ways, we have just broached the surface. You probably have all these other questions going in different directions. I still teach one class at Capistrano Valley Christian Schools. And with high school students, we are spending somewhere between 5 and 6 weeks breaking down this question. 5 and 6 weeks. So hopefully this has given you some sense, maybe a context, way to begin to make sense of this. So do we have a microphone? You've got it right up here, Pastor. If you have a question, want to raise your hand, I don't promise I'll be able to answer all of it, but I will do my best to make sense of it for you. And we can go from there. Yes, go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. It's really enjoyable. Not really a question, I guess. I was just thinking about something. I think the hardest thing with the problem of evil is just when you see it with the perversion of innocence.
That's right.
You know, with children. I think that's probably, I think that's the one that's hardest to reconcile.
I completely agree with you that when we look at children, it's interesting, in Christian Research Journal, and a colleague of mine, Clay Jones, just has an article in the present volume. And the question is, why does God allow suffering to children? And he describes a conversation he had. And again, this doesn't make us go, "Oh, I see why God allows them to suffer," but it gives a little context. He said this is, he actually teaches in our program, I don't know if we mentioned this, but I teach at Biola. We have this graduate apologetics program for professionals like yourself. And he has probably studied the problem of evil as much or more than anybody alive. And he lectures somewhere between 18 and 30 hours on this and has read every book you can think of. In his article, he said, people will push back and raise this question. And the way he'll ask it is, he said, do you think God should not allow evil to happen to children? And typically people say yes. And then he'll say, at what age should children become invincible to evil? In other words, at what age should somebody stop being invincible? And usually, it kind of makes you stop and think, go, huh, what kind of world would it be if every time suffering or evil was going to happen to a child, God stopped it? And one time he had a woman say, 12, I think it should be 12. And he said, really? So God just can stop and allow a 13-year-old? Right? But what's the point? I mean, start to think about it for a second. What would happen to kids if they never experienced the weight of their choices? You might say, well, we live in Orange County. That happens anyways. Well, just don't go there. Right? It does. I mean, I don't get me started. But think about that for a second. What kind of children would be produced in this world if every time some evil or suffering was going to happen, they would stop? One of the most powerful mechanisms I have to teach my kids is to allow them sometimes to experience the weight of their choices. This is maybe the difference. I don't know. Maybe this is a sexist stereotype, but my wife regularly wants to protect my kids from their consequences. She doesn't want them to suffer. I say, let them suffer. That's how they learn. Of course, I put limits on it, but my son wants to reach out and touch the fire. I say, son, that's going to burn your finger. And my wife stops him. I go, well, just let him touch it and burn his finger. And he'll realize that dad's trying to protect him. I'm not going to let him jump in there, right? Which is different between me and my kids and God and us. But as troubling as this question is, we have to start asking, okay, what exactly would God do about this? How would the world be different if he responded? And what would this mean? And I think that can help us, although the innocence and the pain of seeing that happen doesn't go away. It can help us to realize that God is not just looking at one individual. He's looking at the whole world and about how all our choices are interconnected and creating a certain world where people have the free choice to respond to him. But I'm with you. There's no doubt that looking at the pain and innocence of children in itself is enough for some people to just say there can't be a God. I don't buy that, but I get the pain that's involved in that. So thank you for bringing that up.
Our kids brought up the question of why does God allow, like, institutionalized, I guess, evil, like slavery or even ISIS, you know, some big scale injustice. Why doesn't he stop those things?
Well,
there are reasons for not believing
the Bible. In mind. Yeah, this is a good question. One, we don't know the times that God has stopped massive evil in the world. We don't know. I mean, imagine that in World War II, Germany gets the nuclear bomb. I mean, just imagine that. We don't know that God hasn't stopped certain institutions, and we see this happening in the scriptures. So we can't just assume that God just willy-nilly lets any institution go and doesn't hold them to account. But of course, that doesn't answer why God allows some that do horrific, horrific things. Well, part of the answer is institutions are made of individual human beings. There's really no such thing as an institution in itself, apart from the individuals and the people that make it up. So if God is going to have a world where we can respond to him and we can do great things like courage and mercy and sacrifice and love, by definition, we are going to have the freedom to do horrible things that we see actually happening within the world. So I think it's part of the same piece of what we've kind of been talking about. And that realize that institutions are not really different from the individuals who make them up. But the last thing I would say, part of God's response to that, he's given us an institution to respond to the evil in the world. And that's the church. And that's us. I mean, if any of us are sitting here thinking that evil is somewhere out there, we've missed the point. What did Jesus say? It's out of the heart. It's out of the heart that comes wickedness and perversion and sloth and lust and greed. But through the transformation of the Spirit, we are called to go love and care for people in the world and to fight back against that evil with the power God has given us.
To your first question is that you did rock it. I really kind of like thinking and stirring here, but is there an origin in evil? I mean, in the garden was the evil, and you just answered the question earlier. It's the challenge in your heart, but then how does Satan pull into this, that his existence and evil? Because we blame him, but it's really our own choices.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I think, if I understand you correctly, this is one of the toughest questions. Because we were born in God's image. Adam and Eve knew right from wrong. They hadn't experienced it, but they knew it. That's how God could hold them accountable for their choices. But they were tempted by an external force, namely Satan. And because they were self, and they could reflect upon the world and decide, oh, this is best for me, this is not best for me, they listened to the lie about Satan and chose against God and faced the consequences for it. But it raises a question. How did Satan ever sin in the first place? That's a good question, right? Yeah, right. Sometimes I just ask questions. We'll go to the next one.
I was wondering if you could just give me two or three sentences for, like, to answer to a six-year-old why there's evil. Why does God, like, I just need a snippet. Because I love everything I heard, but, and I'm writing it all down, but I know when I get that question, it's like, so can you sum it up in, like, one or two sentences for a young child?
So you've spent the last hour probing the depths of this, and all you want is an answer for a six-year-old. You know what? That's actually a tougher question, isn't it? So this is going to kind of disappoint you. But if a six-year-old, and my son, I won't tell you the ones, but we've had questions with my son and my daughter, these kind of questions. And I don't give answers back to kids. I will ask them questions back. For a few reasons. Number one, I want to know why a six-year-old is asking, why does God allow evil? Where's this question coming from? Is it something they just saw on TV? Did they experience something in their life? Have they seen something? Second is I want to just build a conversation with my kids from the earliest stage. You can ask Daddy, you can ask Mommy anything. We will talk about this. And then, you know, third after that, I'll probably say, do you think the Word of God says anything about this issue? What does the Bible say about it? Because I want my kids to know that when I'm looking for answers, I can philosophize and do things, but I want to know what the Word of God says. So, you know, I might go to a passage like Job and say, gosh, there's a story. Tell them the story of what happened. I might go to Jesus. Is it in Luke 13 when they ask him, you know, why did this tunnel fall and these people die? And Jesus kind of gives an answer to it. I just want to bring them to the Bible and talk to them about it and ask them what they think. And maybe to a six-year-old, you know, when you get towards the end, you say, do you know, have you ever thought about how when we do bad things, we learn from it? Do you think maybe God allows some suffering so we'll learn? Now, that doesn't fully answer it. I get that. But for a six-year-old, it gets them to think. I might say, do you think it's important that we're able to love each other? Like, can I love you the way your teddy bear loves you? And no, because you choose. Well, God didn't want us to just be frozen. He wanted us to choose. Well, if we get to choose to do good things, we can choose bad things, can't we? The question is, are we going to trust God even when we see pain and we see hurt? That's probably where I would go with a six-year-old. I hope that helps a little bit. But the thing you want to do in a context is when kids ask questions, sometimes I think we feel like a few things. Number one, we have to absolutely answer it. And we don't all have the answers, certainly myself included. Number two, we kind of freak out like, oh my goodness, don't ask questions, just have faith. Whereas for me, when I taught high school full time, half my job was just to motivate kids to care. Like, I love it when high school students go, why does God allow evil? Because at least they're thinking, right? So if a six-year-old says, why does God allow evil? I go, gosh, what a good question. Good for you to think about this. What made you think about why God allows evil? What do you think God would say about this? Can you think of any Bible passages that maybe help us make sense of it? And just kind of walk them through it in a conversation is what I would try to do. So, thank you.
The evil of the 20th century seems to far surpass anything evil in the Bible. And at the same time that you have greater evil with 50 million Chinese being starved to death under Mao, with 50 million being put to death under Stalin, with 6 million Jews being killed by Hitler, that evil seems to be far greater than the evil of the Babylonian captivity or the Assyrian captivity or the Jews being slaves in Egypt. And at the same time that you have the greater evil, you don't have the intervention of God in miraculous ways in the 20th century to stop Stalin, to stop Hitler, to stop Mao, to stop ISIS, as you did with the God of the Bible stopping Pharaoh. And therefore, doesn't it leave you with the problem of the God of history does not seem to be the God of the Bible? And if he is, how do you know when he's going to intervene, and how do you know when you can trust him and when you can't?
That's a great question. And I truly appreciate the sincerity with which you ask that question. I can tell this is not just an intellectual head game for you, but this is a real question. One that I think any honest person has had to ask themselves. So I'm not going to stand up here and fully answer why, but maybe I can give some thoughts of how we make sense of this. First off, yes and no, was the evil of the 20th century worse than other things in the Bible? And by the way, I'm not so sure that the evil, yes, it was worse in numbers, possibly for two reasons. Number one, there was a lot more people. Number two, modern technology in the 20th century allowed people to kill at a greater scale than they could have in the past. So you look at some of the leaders, even in the Old Testament and the book of Judges, I don't have very much difficulty believing that if they had that technology, some of the Assyrians and others would have been just as vicious as some of the leaders in the 20th century. And that's why, to me, what is this show? My colleague Clay Jones wrote one of the most compelling articles I've ever read. And it was about human sinful nature that we have. I used to think, well, sinful nature, I've done one or two bad things. He chronicled in the 20th century some of the very things that you're talking about. And he said, we tend to look at this and say, well, Pol Pot was really bad and maybe a couple of his henchmen. Well, Hitler was really bad, except a few of his henchmen. Well, these different leaders were really bad. He said the reality is that the amount of people that willfully participated in this evil was massive. And then even in Germany, the number of people who knew it and did nothing was huge. I mean, Mein Kampf was written by Hitler long before he was brought into power, and they knew what he wanted to do to the Jews. So the point was, when you look at different worldviews and they talk about the reality of evil, I'm persuaded that Jesus got it exactly right. That there's something within human nature that's profoundly flawed. And we can look at ourselves with our comfort in the 21st century and go, well, look at all how terrible these people were in these different settings. But you know what? When the pressure is put on and your life is on the line, this is what some people said in Rwanda. These are people I went to church with. These are people I did business from. Turned and did horrible things. I think this evil shows that some secular answer that there is no real evil that exists, that it's just a twisted gene. There is something deeply and profoundly flawed with human nature. Now, why didn't God intervene? I'm actually not willing to say God didn't intervene. I mean, were massive amounts of people killed? Absolutely. There's nothing I can do to minimize that. That's for sure. Massive amounts of pain we can't even quantify when we look at the quantity and the quality of the evil that was done. But it doesn't mean that God didn't stop it. Those eras have finished. Hitler and Mao Zedong and Pol Pot did not get the nuclear weapon. I'm not willing to say that God did nothing amidst some of the evil and suffering. In fact, I'm actually reading a book right now that's really compelling. Craig Keener is a New Testament scholar. In my view, he's one of the leading scholars in the world. And he has written two full volumes, I don't know, 700, 800, 1,000 pages, massive volumes, meticulously talking about the number of documented miracles going back to the first century all the way through the 20th century in modern day. And he actually says there are hundreds of millions, and if you want to be conservative, tens of millions of people who not only say they believe in miracles, but say they have experienced and witnessed personal miracles in their life. Now, I know a good number of those can be explained away, but I happen to think he documents it pretty powerfully that miracles are happening. And it's interesting, even in the Bible, you read the story of Samuel, it starts off and says, when 1 Samuel 1, when he's interested, when Samuel the prophet is there, is it 1 Samuel 1? Yes, I think it is. It says, this is a time when miracles were not happening very frequently in the land. So we look in the Old Testament and we're told the miraculous stories because God is dealing with the nation of Israel. But if we step back and look at the whole world rather than just through the lens of the nation of Israel, we realize that God does very selective miracles at certain times for reasons we don't always know to reveal himself and make his plan known to the world. Now, why did God allow the Holocaust? I'm not going to sit here and pretend to answer that to you. I'll tell you one thing a Jew said that at least is worth mentioning. This was Dennis Prager. He has this Old Testament series I was listening to, and he said it's just bothered him why God would allow the Holocaust. And he said, I'm not going to say this is why, but maybe God allowed it because that's what it took for the Jews to have a state, to be protected. Now, if I just say that, I sound like the arrogant person who's making simplicity of it, but this is someone who's actually Jewish. And there may be something to that. So those are some thoughts. I'm not going to tell you why, but for me, I'll tell you what does it. When it's all said and done, is because I believe in the resurrection of Jesus. I really believe in the resurrection of Jesus. And I have good historical reason for this. This is the kind of world that God is actually in control of. We don't see it. We don't understand it. But God has raised his son from the dead. And ultimately, all evil will end someday. As Mother Teresa said, in light of eternity, the evil and suffering in this world will be like one night in a dingy hotel.